Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I can be far Senator Clinton, but I got to acknowledge this is some, at the top three. These are some talented horses coming into the stretch here. I mean, get out of the way. We're going to have a hell of a 39 days.
Democratic strategist James Carville on NBC's Meet the Press yesterday, and a hell of a, well, 38 days now. He said that yesterday, with trends like Obama and Huckabee suddenly being up in Iowa, Obama actually leading Hillary Clinton by 4 points now in the latest poll, Huckabee just about in a dead heat. But my first guest today is a leading political journalist who is having a change of heart about what it means to cover presidential campaigns. Mark Halperin, a senior political analyst for Time magazine. He's the former ABC News political director and the author of two books on the 2008 presidential campaign, The Way to Win, Taking the White House in 2008, and The Undecided Voter's Guide to the Next President, his latest. But maybe you saw his op-ed in the New York Times yesterday saying he has changed his mind about how a good campaign relates to the making of a good president. So we'll talk about that. And also this morning's surprise announcement that you may have heard on the news there, that Trent Lott intends to resign from the Senate by the end of the year. Hey, Mark, welcome back to WNYC.
Always happy to talk to you, Brian. Thanks for having me on.
Where are you today? On the trail somewhere?
I'm back in New York City for just a little bit. I'll be headed back out on the trail soon, but there's a little battery recharging that needs to go on every so often.
Even for an energizer bunny like you. Let's do Trent Lott real quick, since this is just breaking now. Did you hear about it, and do you have any idea why he's resigning?
I think this is one of those true wants to spend more time with his family cases.
Really?
Yeah, you know, being in the minority is no fun. I think if the Republicans were in the majority or had a reasonable prospect of becoming the majority, I think he would have stuck around. But he's older. I think he would have retired from Congress completely and not sought re-election except for Katrina. His home was destroyed. A lot of the homes of his constituents were, and I think he felt he needed to stay to try to fight within Congress, use his seniority to help the region. But now I think he feels a little bit frustrated with the pace of Congress, being in the minority, and again, with probably not much of a prospect that Republicans will gain seats in 2008, and wants to go and enjoy life now with his remaining years on our planet.
But he didn't say he wasn't going to run for re-election, simply that he's going to leave. He's going to leave in the middle of his term, right?
He is, but you know, I think once you make a decision that you're not enjoying it anymore, you leave, and you're seeing that. You saw that with Denny Hastert, who was no longer Speaker of the House, also in a leadership position, and again, once you go from being in the majority in a leadership position to being in the minority, it's just not the same, particularly in the partisan atmosphere of Washington, where things are such that if you're in the minority, you're not given very much authority.
Right, and we saw a few years ago when the Democrats thought they were going to be in kind of a permanent minority for a while, people like John Corzine leave the Senate to go do other things, and a bunch of people like that. But are you saying, Mark, that if you're in the majority party and have more power, then you're not so interested in spending more time with your family?
Well, it's a cost benefit, Brian. We both have jobs that keep us pretty busy, and we'd both like to spend more time doing other things. But if you're enjoying your work, if everything's fun at work, then you feel you can find a balance that works.
And
if,
I assume
if your
that
job's less enjoyable, other personal stuff starts to look more important.
A nice, earnest answer to my snarky question. and I assume that Mississippi, I'm not remembering offhand, but I assume they have a Republican governor who can appoint a Republican to replace the Republican Trent Lott.
They do indeed. When I remind you, you'll recall that Haley Barbour, the former National Republican chairman, is the governor just reelected in Mississippi, and he'll certainly pick a Republican, a younger person almost certainly, certainly to have that seat and to probably hold it for the party.
Of course, multiple time guest on this show in his own right, Haley Barbour, back when he was the RNC chairman.
And he has one of my favorite lines in all of politics when people ask him a question that he thinks suggests that they're thinking he's naive. He says, "I was born at night, but it wasn't last night."
Okay, let's talk about you. People saw your op-ed piece maybe yesterday in the Week in Review in the New York Times about your change of heart on how to do your job, how to cover presidential campaigns. Did you have some kind of epiphany?
Well, you know, the book What It Takes by Richard Ben Cramer, really one of the best books ever written about presidential politics, a book I still love, but a book that influenced me and a generation of other reporters to think that there's a real tight connection, maybe even a one-to-one correlation, between what it takes to get elected president, the kind of heroic transcontinental process by which people run for the office, and then to do a good job in the office. And that if you look at the last two presidents, both of whom were better presidential candidates than they were presidents in many ways. They were two for two in running and running for the office, and each and not flawless in the White House. And I think it's better for us to focus our coverage not on who's good at polls, standing in the polls or making a good attack ad or giving a good speech, but who actually has the ability to do this job rather than just to run for it.
And I guess the question there is the relationship between campaigning and effective campaigning and what that says about what kind of a president you'll make. I guess I've always been skeptical of making too much of a connection between campaigning and government, because it always seemed to me that there are different sets of skills. Campaigning may be something about how effective you'll be at winning support for your policies, because that's the politics, but maybe not much about whether your policies will be good for America. So why emphasize the horse race so much?
Well, I think it's a real question. It's one of the things I tried to suggest in my piece in the Times yesterday, right, and in my book that you were nice enough to mention, The Undecided Voter's Guide, that there's so much information available to voters about who's up in the polls, who makes good ads, et cetera, rather than who would be the best president. I think if you're on the right side of the digital divide, if you can afford my slim paperback book, there's more information available than there's ever been. That's not about the horse race, but that is about who can do the job the best, who's got the best policies, and is best prepared for the tough parts of the job. But there certainly is in the media a lot of information that is about the horse race, and I would like to see less of that, yeah, a better balance between horse race and giving the people the information they need to make the best choice.
I also think, and I'll say this man to man, that it's a very male bias, that men are more apt to see things in terms of who's good at competition, like sports, and men are most of the political reporters. So that biases us away from how well a president will address poverty or peacemaking or lots of other things that are not based on vanquishing your opponent like a campaign is. Do you agree?
I think that's a great point, Brian. And you know, for a generation or two since the advent of television, but even before that, Americans have seen our unique process of picking a leader as a horse race, as a pretty exciting process. And make no mistake, this is about as exciting a pair of races as I've covered. There's certainly a genuine built-in excitement to the process, and there's a fair amount of people who are interested, who are part of an audience, who look for information about the sort of sport of politics. But that's not what's most important. What's most important is to try to provide as much information as possible to people so they can make the right choice for themselves, their family, and the country, whether they live in Iowa, New Hampshire, New York, or anywhere else. And again, part of the reason I wrote The Undecided Voter's Guide to the Next President is to try to be part of that providing of information so people can say, side-by-side comparison, what would Obama do, what would Romney do, et cetera, if they're picked as the next leader.
And by the way, in the clip that we open with of James Carville, you keep using the word horse race, or the term horse race. Let me replay this, and you'll see how directly he went there.
I can be far sent to Clinton, but I got to acknowledge this is at the top three. These some talented horses coming into the stretch here. I mean, get out of the way. We're going to have a hell of a 39 days.
Talk about covering the campaign as a horse race.
Well, there's no question that part of what the excitement is these are incredible candidates. And they're not just incredible candidates in terms of, as James suggested, how they perform out on the trail. Incredible stories. The first African-American president of the Harvard Law Review, one of America's most successful trial lawyers, the most famous woman in the world, a former first lady. Those on the Democratic side are three fascinating candidates. And the ones on the Republican side are as interesting. One of America's most successful venture capitalists, mayor of New York City during 9/11, an actor and lobbyist who rose from real humble origins, and one of the great war heroes from one of the great military families of the last century. So this is a group of people with great life stories, you know, who are performing out there every day, in the case of the Democrats, at least, at a pretty high level of competition, Republican side competition, although I don't know that any of them have hit their stride yet. And that makes for a fascinating race, and again, a fascinating group of people, one of whom will be our next president.
So we can take phone calls for Mark Halperin, senior political analyst for Time Magazine, his latest book, The Undecided Voter's Guide to the Next President. And you can talk about your own assessment process. What does matter to you in deciding who to vote for, let's say, in these presidential primaries? I know we have a lot of undecided voters. on both sides of the aisle in our listening audience. What are you looking for, and are you getting it from campaign coverage? 212-433-WNYC, and anything you want to ask about the horse race or the issues, 212-433-9692 from Mark Halperin this morning, or post to our comments page at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. So in this spirit, especially talking about the manly bias of male politics, let me play a Mike Huckabee ad that's making the rounds online. I'm sure you know this. This is, I guess, a TV commercial, or maybe it's just an online commercial. It's definitely a visual thing, but the audio will definitely give you the idea.
My plan to secure the border? Two words. Chuck Norris. Mike Huckabee's a lifelong hunter who'll protect our Second Amendment rights. Chuck Norris doesn't endorse. He tells America how it's gonna be. I'm Mike Huckabee, and I approve this message. So did Chuck. Chuck Norris approved.
So, Mark Halperin, is he after the macho vote, the irony vote, or what?
Well, the irony vote is probably huge in Iowa, Brian, so it's certainly part of it. You know, Huckabee actually has a new ad up today, which you can look at. I actually posted it on our website at Time, thepage.time.com. That's a more traditional ad that talks about him as a authentic conservative and shows him addressing a crowd. The one you played was an ad that aired in Iowa, still airing in Iowa, uh-huh. I think. And it's meant, I think, largely to capture attention. Chuck Norris is a more recognizable figure than Mike Huckabee and has endorsed him. And so Huckabee is still, despite the boom lit of coverage he's gotten in the last few weeks and his rise in the polls in Iowa, he still needs more people to know who he is. And I think he's trying to show his sense of humor as well, which is one of his more appealing sides.
And if Huckabee is going to become the great conservative hope, is that what is leading him to surge to a tie for first in Iowa?
Well, certainly on the social issues, all of the other leading four Republican candidates have real questions about their current and past support for conservative social positions like abortion. Mike Huckabee is a social conservative, but now that he's having success, questions are being raised about his record on taxes, his record on immigration, and some of his current positions on those issues. And it is testament to the fact that this is now a five-person contest rather than a four-person contest, that some of the biggest guns raised over the weekend in what became a exceedingly contentious Republican nomination fight in Saturday and Sunday were raised and pointed at Huckabee.
He's very conservative on abortion, to the point of proposing a constitutional ban, but his rivals are saying when he was governor of Arkansas, he raised taxes, he enlarged government, and he's a moderate on immigration. I want to play a clip of Huckabee on this show. Now, granted, this goes back to last January when maybe we could argue things were a little bit different in Iraq, but here's what he was saying about the war at that time. This is January of this year.
We can't love your freedom as Americans more than you as Iraqis love it yourself. And that's got to be a strong, stern message that we give to the Iraqi government. And it may mean that we shift some of our troops from the more dangerous combat zones of Baghdad and put them in the safer zones and tell them, bring your Iraqi troops into the more really volatile areas.
Now, Mark, as I recall, you were the guest right after him that day to do a little bit of analysis. And you remember he was very much trying to make himself seem palatable as a crossover candidate to New York and other Northeast voters coming on this show. But there he was talking pretty tough about the Maliki government and when he would or would not support maintaining troops.
Well, Iraq is one of the many issues on which Huckabee has tried to show more foreign policy depth. Again, as from the political point of view, as this thing goes forward, if he continues to have success, he's going to really be challenged as a governor from a state. He was commander in chief of the Arkansas National Guard. We've seen a previous presidential candidate tout that as a credential to be commander in chief. But he's going to have to probably be more specific. And in this debate coming up on Wednesday, I suspect he'll be challenged on a range of issues, including probably foreign policy.
And since he seems to have an ironic side, and since it's the Republican YouTube debate on Wednesday night, maybe he's positioned to do pretty well.
I think so. You know, one of the things about Mike Huckabee is he comes across as sincere, not arrogant. And whereas you look at the other candidates, Thompson, Giuliani and Romney in particular, although they're experienced, we've all seen them get rattled, lose their temper, lose their bearings. It just does not, at least so far, it does not happen to Mike Huckabee. He's a real grounded guy and a real self-possessed guy, and that will serve him well as these attacks have started to come. He's not changed his demeanor one whit, and it's a demeanor, again, that a lot of voters find attractive.
We'll continue in a minute with Mark Halperin. We've placed a link on our website, by the way, to that op-ed piece that he had yesterday in the New York Times about his change of approach to covering presidential campaigns. We'll also play some clips of Rudy Giuliani and Mitt Romney going after each other over the weekend in the ways that Mark was just describing, questioning each other's bona fides on some particular issues. And since we are talking issues and we do emphasize issues, I'll ask Mark what issues he's finding most resonate with the voters in Iowa and New Hampshire and South Carolina, and are they different right now from state to state? So stay with us, and our lines are full. We'll get some of your calls and your comments to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Stay tuned. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with Time Magazine senior political analyst Mark Halperin, author of The Undecided Voter's Guide to the Next President. And for those undecided, especially in Iowa and New Hampshire right now, Mitt Romney had this to say over the weekend about Rudy Giuliani.
He is pro-choice like Hillary Clinton. He is in favor of civil union like Hillary Clinton. He is in favor of sanctuary cities like Hillary Clinton. And the record of ethical conduct from, in this case, Bernie Kerik, reminds us very much of the administration that Hillary Clinton was part of in Washington.
So obviously he's trying to compare Rudy Giuliani and link him to the views of Hillary Clinton. How did civil unions get in there? I thought they're against gay marriage, but civil unions aren't such a big thing.
Well, most of the Republican leading Republican candidates have been a little wishy-washy on civil unions, at times supporting them, although claiming that their support only was based on using it to kind of take the punch out of pushes for gay marriage. So none of them, I think, are purely pure on that issue. But
what about Romney? Because, of course, he was governor of Massachusetts when the gay marriage thing happened there, and he was very much opposed to it. But was he even opposed to civil unions?
He was for them for a time, again, saying that he thought they would be a good way to kind of take the drive for marriage out of the way. But he's come now to change and say that he largely opposes civil unions as well.
So here's what Rudy Giuliani over the weekend had to say about Mitt Romney.
He had one of the weaker records of any governor on economics.
Exactly.
The Cato Institute said he was C for governors, put him in the bottom tier of governors. I think he's going to have a hard time defending his economic record.
And this is new for Giuliani because he's been campaigning as the sort of above-it-all candidate, a smile and a handshake. He was such a celebrity outside of New York that was doing it for him, and all of a sudden he's getting down in the weeds.
Brian, both front-running New Yorkers, Hillary Clinton and Rudy Giuliani, preferred the campaign when the effort was not based on negative attacks. Both of them have now turned to attacking their opponents. Their staff argues with some justification because they were being attacked for so long, and you can only stand to be attacked and not counterpunch in politics for so long. So you're seeing now both Giuliani and Clinton, often unprovoked on the campaign trail, lashing out in Giuliani's case, mostly at Mitt Romney, but also at Fred Thompson. And in the case of Hillary Clinton, at Barack Obama, because they feel that if they don't change the dynamic, if they just allow the attacks to come in their direction, that is not a winning dynamic for them.
Let's take some phone calls, and our first call comes on what we started with. And for those of you who weren't listening 20 minutes ago, it was announced this morning. It's not officially announced yet, but I guess it was leaked this morning that Trent Lott is going to be resigning from the Senate, not just as he did a few years ago from his majority leader position after the controversy over his pro-Strom Thurmond comments, but from the entire Senate and in the middle of his term at the end of this year, not waiting till his term expires. And Tim in Montville has a thought about that. Hi, Tim.
Hi, how are you, Brian?
Okay, what you got?
Well, I thought I read it this morning in the pause that came while I was waiting to be put on the air. I looked up the New York Times. I'm now quoting.
Uh-huh.
From this morning, it says, while the exact reason Lott is stepping down before he finishes his term is unknown, the general speculation is that a quick departure immunizes Lott against tougher restrictions in a new lobbying law that takes effect at the end of the year.
Uh-huh.
That law would require senators to wait 2 years before entering the lucrative world of lobbying Congress. So my reading of that is that if he retires now, he saves himself the year that he still would be in Congress plus another year, which would be added on by this new law.
Yeah, and we have some posts on our comments page, Mark, some of them sharply worded, that say, what are you kidding? Of course that's the reason he's stepping down. Wants to spend more time with his family. What are you kidding?
Well, I had no idea about that, I confess. I've been so focused on the presidential race that the new congressional lobbying rules are not something I'm totally familiar with, although I now recall that that was put in place. And that makes sense to me. I will say that I wouldn't be surprised if the guy became a lobbyist, but I also wouldn't be surprised if you spend more time with his family, too.
And somebody else wrote, as for Hastert, he's getting out of town one step in advance of the sheriff.
Well, there were some questions raised about his personal finances and a huge profit he made based on the purchase of some property in a congressional action, which I was surprised did not get more attention. I don't know that there's an investigation into that, but I think certainly to the extent there was anything there, he's less likely to be looked at if he's no longer in Congress.
Charlie in Newark, you're on WNYC. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, it's great to be here. I just wanted to say that, although I think the guest makes some valid points about covering the opinions of candidates, I feel that if reporters get too much into deciding who would be the best governor of our country in any level of politics, it's going to lead too much to possibility of bias where, you know, When I think that for the most part, these candidates all have their plans and they all have their various supporters and detractors. And I think that as a voter, it's my responsibility to decide who the best governor is, not for a reporter to come and say, well, just so you know, Hillary's plan is better than Obama's plan or Giuliani's plan is better than
right.
Huckabee's
but,
plan.
But I would think that our job as journalists, and Mark, give us your take on this too, goes much deeper than just reporting on who's saying what about whom or what's in their plans, but to do deep analysis of their plans in an unbiased way, but that, you know, takes into account their past records, issues of their character, issues of their ability to prevail politically, you know, and to provide you, the voter, with the most possible useful information to kind of go deep into those things, look at the pros and cons as you know, different people see them of the different plans, the different policy proposals that candidates come out with. You want that, Charlie, right?
Well, yes. That's fine. It's just this notion of trying to make the determination as a reporter. I mean, it's fine to endorse and it's fine to...
Right, but what Mark was saying originally was that what he's moving away from now is the belief that by looking at how effectively somebody campaigns, it's going to be an important marker or a vital marker of how good a president that will be.
Well, I think how well someone campaigns tells us how well they've been able to explain their plan and that their plan mm-hmm. has gained popularity. Now, whether or not the people are fools for believing that,
yeah.
I don't really think that's the place of the press to make that decision.
Charlie, thank you. And Mark, do you think that that's what effective campaigning is? I'm not sure that it is. I mean, I was watching that NBC Meet the Press roundtable yesterday, and Mary Madeline supporting Fred Thompson, whenever she would talk about his policy positions, she would almost make an excuse for it. And she would say, you know, it's not a policy paper. It's not an issues paper. Like, somehow that's a bad, wonky thing. But it's a real reflection of his conservative values. So there's almost a skepticism about voting on the basis of people's policies, at least as Mary Madeline and some others in the business apparently see it.
Well, first of all, I agreed with everything Charlie said. I think it's absolutely right. I defy anybody to read the Undecided Voters Guide that I wrote and say, oh, Halperin thinks this person would be the best president.
Right.
It's a fair book, and I think that Charlie stated exactly right. We should lay out for people what their ideas are, and you stated it well as also, Brian. I think we should lay out for people their plans. We shouldn't just reprint them. We should give some expert sense of what other people think about them or what they're likely to do. One of the things I do in the book is try to give people a sense of the priorities, I think, that different candidates would put on different issues based on what they've said and what they've done in their careers. But then it's up to the individuals to decide who the best person would be for themselves, their family, and the country. You got to use your head. You got to use your gut a little bit as well. In terms of Mary Madeline's comments, I think within the context of that Meet the Press political roundtable, there is a certain sort of anti-intellectual, anti-substance ethos that exists. But I think Mary would argue in a different context that ideas do matter in politics, and that she believes Fred Thompson has been specific, which he has been in the last few weeks on some big issues, and that is something that would appeal to a lot of voters, if not necessarily the chattering class.
So as you travel in these early primary states, do you find different issues resonate more strongly in different places? For example, on the Republican side, is abortion a bigger thing in Iowa than New Hampshire, where Huckabee is not surging?
Well, yes, although that, I don't think that's peculiar to 2007, 2008. Abortion has always been a bigger issue within the Republican Party in Iowa, where there are more social conservatives than in New Hampshire, where independents can vote in the primary and where the sort of class of Republicans or category of Republicans that exists tends to be more concerned with economic issues, with immigration, a big issue in both states, rather than the social issues, which are a big part of the party in the South and Midwest.
What are you hearing about the war from Republicans? Because one of the things that surprises me the most in the debates is that the leading Republican candidates, Ron Paul being the obvious exception, and I don't mean to say he's a leading candidate, at least in the polls, but you know, the big guns seem to take a very sort of pro-Bush, pro-troop surge position. You know, it's almost like there's no distance between them and the president's policy, even though the polls out there show that Americans in both parties are pretty disgusted with the war at this point.
Well, the most common and cynical explanation for that our colleagues usually use is that within the Republican Party, the polls are different, that within the Republican electorate, there is still support for President Bush's policy in Iraq, and that's why they have the position they do. I think in most cases, that's certainly part of what's guiding them. But what's also true is that they really believe it. Their worldview suggests that if the United States withdrew from Iraq, that not only would there be repercussions within Iraq that America would be responsible for, but that it would send a message around the world that al-Qaeda had defeated the United States, and that the United States military force and word of commitment could not be trusted to complete a mission. And so they're sticking with that now. When the general election comes, I suspect whoever the Republican nominee is will in all likelihood create more distance between themselves and President Bush on a range of issues, including Iraq. But that won't come till probably the spring.
Do you think that Huckabee, based on the clip that we played from his appearance on the show earlier in the year, and maybe from other things that you've heard from him out there, has left himself more wiggle room than the other candidates to distance himself from the war?
If this were a game of logic rather than politics, there's no question that'd be right. I think any of them have enough room to distance themselves when and if they decide that's the right thing to do politically, and when, in their judgment, that's the right direction to go. I've asked all the people I know who are smart about politics and involved in the Bush administration how many combat troops they think will be on the ground in Iraq on Election Day in 2008. And most believe it's a number pretty close to what there is now. And that reality, I think, will drive the Republican nominee's position on Iraq to some extent, regardless of who it is, regardless of what commitments or statements they've made in the past.
Mark Halperin, Time Magazine senior political analyst and author of The Undecided Voter's Guide to the Presidential Election, my guest on WNYC, and Patrick in West Orange, you're on WNYC. Hi, Patrick.
Yes, hi. How you doing?
All right.
Interesting program. Two quick things. Number one, since your guest is a political reporter, and the other thing is about his book. Firstly, when do you think that the media, the mainstream media, and the other candidates actually also, when do you think that they are going to stop treating Rudy Giuliani with such kid gloves? They're all giving him a pass on the 9/11 thing. He's running as Mr. 9/11, and his record there is very, you know, weak and kind of a fraud actually. The second thing, the undecided voter, what's your impression of why voters are undecided? And I often see this even at late stages. Perhaps now it's a little early, but even at late stages you often find undecided voters. To me it seems like they're just not thinking, they're uninformed, they're not paying attention. Is that what you think makes an undecided voter? They just aren't paying attention and they're kind of ignorant, frankly.
Well, I'll answer the second question first. I think that the there are some people who I would say less, I'd say less that they're ignorant than they're just busy. And part of the reason I wrote the book was to give busy people a one paperback book, one literary roof under which to read an apples to apples side by side comparison of the candidates. For people who like you who are interested enough in politics to call into a show like this, you're constantly following the candidates on the internet, on television, radio, magazines, etc. But for most people, they're just too busy. And while politics touches their lives in some ways for sure, it seems remote in most ways to their day-to-day lives and the obligations they have. So I think a lot of people do decide at the end simply because it's the only time they have to focus. And now, Brian, I confess I forgot the first question.
Well, the first question was about Rudy Giuliani.
Oh, and when he's going to get scrutiny. You know, it's one of the great questions. Great mysteries of this campaign cycle, Giuliani's success in defining the election on his terms to dealing effectively with what little scrutiny he's gotten has really been remarkable and accounts for his front-running status in the national campaign, even though just a few months ago people like me said he could not be nominated by the Republican Party. I think the scrutiny is going to come now. I think though you'll see independent groups putting more scrutiny on him, maybe in the form of negative ads. But I think it's possible he'll win the Republican nomination without getting much scrutiny. And I think there may be those in the Republican Party who regret it if Giuliani is nominated, and then the tough scrutiny comes, because the Democrats will have months and months with the single focus on Giuliani rather than now with this big Republican field where he gets his share of scrutiny, but it's divided with all the other candidates who are also being scrutinized.
On the Democratic side, and we've been talking mostly about the Republicans for today, and we just have a few minutes left, Obama now leads Clinton by 4 points in the new ABC News Washington Post poll in Iowa. Are there issues propelling him to that lead, issue differences? Or is it, you know, a perception of the individual?
You know, I don't want to denigrate the ABC Washington Post poll because it's a good poll. But as everybody knows who follows this closely, it's difficult to poll in Iowa. And if you look at the margin of error in that poll, I think we might be making too much of the notion that Obama has surged ahead or moved ahead. He may be ahead. But the reality is, as James Carville said on Meet the Press, spot on, as we say in Louisiana, any of the three of them, Clinton, Obama, or Edwards, could end up winning those Iowa caucuses. All of them probably have support around the mid-20s, high 20s. And so the extent Obama is doing better, and I think he's doing just fine, it's because he's spent a lot of time there. He's spent a lot of money on television ads. He's moved around the state. He's from a neighboring state. And Senator Clinton has had a bad few weeks, or her worst few weeks, or only bad, really bad weeks in quite a long time. And so I think while Senator Obama may be ahead, he's not ahead by much, and we should look at Iowa now as will likely be all the way through the end of the year and into the caucuses on January 3rd,
like
which is a true toss-up.
A three-way dead heat. But but I'm still curious about how they're judging, and you see it when you go out there, so shed some light here. I mean, when we say Hillary Clinton had a bad few weeks, this is usually supposed to mean her answer to the question of driver's licenses for illegal immigrants in that debate, and this idea that she's a candidate who's being so cautious that she doesn't stand for anything. That's kind of a general character question. That's different than comparing, you know, Obama's health care plan to Clinton's health care plan, which she tried to do. I guess she thinks her health care plan is a winner compared to his with the mandatory coverage and things like that. So what do you think the voters in Iowa particularly are actually looking for? Are they just looking for the, you know, like George Stephanopoulos and Andrew Sullivan on ABC yesterday both said Obama is the candidate who represents the most change. And, you know, that, but that's an abstract notion.
Well, Brian, you've asked just a huge, like, doctoral thesis question, and it's something that we're working on at Time for a story in the next couple of weeks about how do voters decide? Clearly, while Obama and Clinton both at times have tried to create differences between their plans, although Obama occasionally will say that there's really not much of a difference between them on policy, there aren't huge differences between the Democratic candidates on major issues. There are some, and I don't mean to minimize them, and I think people should understand them. But in the main, I do think it's mostly this question of electability, character, credibility, the ability to bring the country together, the ability to make change. Sometimes those are in conflict. Someone who talks about bringing the country together in the eyes of some Democrats won't do enough to fight with Republicans to bring about liberal change the way President Bush brought about conservative change. So all of these questions are swirling out there in Iowa. You know, there was the question about driver's license during this period. There was also something that got a bit more attention in Iowa, which is this planting of questions by Clinton staffers to give her an easier time in town meetings.
Right.
I think that got more attention in Iowa than it did nationally, and that's something Iowans, I think, don't particularly like. All of this, goes into the unique caucus process, into the mix of what voters are hearing about in the media and seeing for themselves. A lot of it is the on-the-ground campaigning. When voters in Iowa have the luxury of going to see candidates two, three, four times, what is their impression in person of hearing Obama speak, of hearing Clinton speak, of hearing Edwards speak, or Biden or Dodd or Richardson? And there's a lot of that going on day-to-day now, and there will be the rest of the month, and that will be a lot of it. There's a great story in the New York Times today about Obama, you know, personally courting someone to be one of his leaders in Western Iowa.
We're over time, but I want to play one more clip, and this is from the Democrat Saturday radio address. I was kind of astonished to see that it was given by the former commander in the Iraq War, General Ricardo Sanchez, and here's a clip.
That failure continues today. At its base is the mistaken belief, despite years of evidence to the contrary, that victory can be achieved through the application of military power alone.
Wow. How did Ricardo Sanchez, of all people, wind up giving the Democrats radio address and coming out so much against the war?
Well, there's a number of retired military who feel that the policy is not working and won't work, and he's probably the most prominent, and obviously doing the radio address is a big deal, but there's certainly a liberation when you take off the uniform and when you retire, and the view of a lot of people in the military is shared by Sanchez, although certainly not all of them, and it does raise the suspicion among some critics of the war that people who are actively serving now might have more doubts than they're willing to let on, and they raise the specter of Vietnam.
Is he crawling out of his tarnished reputation from the Abu Ghraib era at all?
Well, I think to the extent people know that he was involved there, he may feel that this is part of his effort to rehabilitate himself. But I also, again, I'm not so cynical. I think probably he's saying what he thinks is right, and the Democrats are glad to have him because he's a validator with a unique perspective.
Mark Halperin, author of The Undecided Voter's Guide to the Next President and senior political analyst for Time magazine. Thanks a lot.
Great to talk to you, as always, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up in a minute, how immigrants learn English in New York.